I've become interested over the past years in who I am in terms of my genealogy, and I've spent quite a lot of time and apparently money trying to find out some of the story of my past, where I sit in the world, how I've come to be. And it's fascinating, at least in my family, to find out some of the stories and to make connections that previously I would not have been able to make. And I know that Lorraine's been doing some of that recently as well. The reality is that the most of my story is not that interesting, in that at most periods in my story, in my past, in my people, you throw a stone within about 20 miles of here and you'll likely hit one of my relatives, at least in some kind of distance. It's likely to be a fifth or sixth cousin in some fashion. There are some interesting threads, though, including a connection to royalty. Your Majesty will do next time you talk to me, which actually isn't as exclusive a club as you'd think. About one in four of us are connected to royalty in some fashion. So you can work out whether that's you or the person next to you or the one beyond that. To get a bit further, I've recently done one of those DNA test things, which are so well advertised. And the inevitable reality even of that test is that if you throw a stone anywhere between about 20 miles of here, you'll still likely hit a relative of mine, according to that test. But with a nice exotic little touch of Scotland, a bit of a few percent of Scottish within me, a hint of Swedish. So I am a Viking after all. And more than a smattering of German blood in the little mix that makes me. But the reality is in that in my search, I'm actually no closer really than what I likely expected. Who I am actually has much more to do with my relationship to the people around me. It's more meaningful and significant, I think, in lots of ways, that I'm an uncle, that I'm a son, that I'm a grandson, that I'm a brother, because all of these things are a result of relationship. I'm more understood in terms of some of my long-term friendships. I'm probably understood better even by the way that this church has called me to be their minister and to serve them. I'm better understood in that context than many others, than a percentage of my DNA. All of these places, all of these people have a bearing on who I am because of the relationship I have and even the proximity, the intimacy I share amongst those and many more places. But even in all those places, I'm unlikely to find a definitive answer as to who I am because I am more about who I have been created to be outside of my genetics and the physiology that I bring because I am more than those things. Peter, in his letter, tells us a bit about that subject. He says, as you come to him, the living stone. As is so often the case in the Bible, there is the language of metaphor, this time a very ancient one picked up from prophets and prayers and poems from thousands of years ago. Peter takes all that he understands of Jesus and connects him to the image of a cornerstone, the vast and structurally important foundation stone of a large and impressive building, this time most likely connecting us to the image of the temple at Jerusalem, an image that most of his listeners could work with easily because they understood the sheer size and importance of those stones. The stone that we're connected to is definitely different by definition to a vast rock. Imagery keen in Peter's mind, but because a rock is rugged and solid and yet often not usable in its raw form until it's somehow molded or shaped for its purpose. So the stone that we're talking about is one that has been prepared. It's one that has a particular purpose in mind. We also heard that Peter wants us to be clear that this is a living stone, as an expression of who Jesus is. It's all very well painting a picture of a historical Jesus as an example of good and right and truth, as we would often want to do, but there is something very different and insistent about the resurrected and ascended Jesus, as we would say, which is another way of saying that one of the biggest claims that we make in Christianity is not just that there was a series of historical claims, but that there is something very real, something very present about God's presence. That Jesus still lives in a very real and meaningful way. As you come to him, the living stone, rejected by humans, but chosen by God and precious to him. The whole question of Jesus as understood in that way is one that people have always struggled with, mostly because of an issue with conformity. We universally struggle, I think, as human beings when things don't meet our expectations. And part of the story of Jesus is a radical defiance of the expectations of thousands of years from the people that God had trusted with an understanding of that situation, never mind what anybody else would think. It's clear that Jesus was entirely the living stone that we needed him to be, but in so many ways, he was not the living stone that those people then wanted him to be. Even now, these words come with the same confession that Jesus will so often defy our expectations and is not often even who the church wants him to be, because so often we will be asked by him to get our hands dirtier than we would want to love deeper than we're prepared to go further than we are willing. But what's key is that whatever ways that Jesus was rejected and is rejected by humanity, that he is precious to God, in which there is no greater security. I'm grateful then that Peter pulls us into this story and says, you also are like living stones, because it releases us to an order and potential and precious significance that tells me more about who I am than my genealogy and physicality ever could. I'm shaped for purpose, Peter says, by a creator who knows what we can be useful for. That's good to know. And where we can find significance in. No two stones the same, each being a complex expression of the circumstances that it was formed and founded in. But like a dry stone wall, if you like, each has its perfect place to hold everything together. Peter says, we're being built into a spiritual house or temple. Except the image is not that we are a rugged and rough wall like that dry stone wall, but that we are being made into a much more precious and significant building, if you like, a spiritual house or even a temple that brings with it the assumption that part of our purpose is to be able to play host to have within our midst the Holy of Holies. That's what the picture of the temple does for us. It's a way of expressing that this is where God lives. Again, this is a critical assertion of God, that upon our acceptance of Jesus by faith, that we are allowing and accepting a call and a purpose and a presence in our life that says that we will neither be alone or without direction. So we're being built into a spiritual house or a temple, and that we've been given this name, Holy Priesthood. A call towards Holy Priesthood probably sounds like a dramatic and maybe exclusive call, but actually it's one of the more liberating principles amongst our thoughts today. At the old temple way, there was the designated space for the Holy of Holies right in the middle, and other restricted spaces where at only the right times and in the right ways and in the right seasons, the right offerings, the right sacrifices, and appropriate worship would be given in order to offer appropriate worship of God. But perhaps more significantly, to make every person right with God, and only certain priests at certain times and some circumstances, only the high priest could offer those things and do those things. So that was a narrow path in that you had to be a priest, you had to have the right genetics even in that situation, the right calling, the right upbringing to allow you access to the most intimate and precious place of God. But when Jesus died, part of the imagery of that time of crucifixion, the curtain that separated that place from the rest of the temple and every division and dividing place was torn so that everyone might come and find intimacy with the God who created you. To be called a holy priesthood then is to offer everyone the chance to draw close to God and to have access to God, to be able to pray or talk to God and understand that you are heard. And in that way, again, we're able to answer that question, who am I? A holy priesthood. I'm heard. I'm given calling and a special place before God. Peter then encourages us to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus. Every relationship is different, but all of our relationships require, I think, give and take. And every relationship of true worth will actually bring about change in each other. When Jesus was put onto the cross, and as those brutal nails were put in, and as his human spirit was relinquished, there came an end to the sacrificial system. It was a one-time sacrifice that was of God, which brought about an ultimate change to the way we do things. But that doesn't mean that it was the end of our need to let things go, to put things aside and allow a relationship with God to change us. The call is simply, and to our great challenge, to accept that there is pain and bad stuff, we would often call it sin, in the world around us, that we participate in, that we cultivate, that we oddly cherish in harmful ways, either out of laziness or greed or pride or lust or many other things beside. We're prepared to participate in injustice and prejudice, even beyond our understanding. Therefore, the acceptable sacrifice that we make now is to say that we're not entirely in control, that we don't want to participate, and that we want to find a new and a better way to do things. Normally, that letting go of and accepting our part is hard. To say that we've done something wrong to somebody is difficult because it will often come with a loss of pride. It comes with the grim acceptance of the pain that we've caused and is because of that very thing. But what we hear from Peter is the deep reality, that although it may cost you in lots of ways to let go of the things that cause others and ourselves pain, all those little addictions and failings, the one thing that God will not do when we lay down those things is inflict upon us shame. I think we so often get caught in our human lives in patterns of shame. And yet what God has said, what Peter repeats in this letter, is that that is not what God will put upon us at the admission of our failings. And actually, one of the greatest sins of the church is to have developed this habit of shame to those who don't fit it, who don't fit in with it, and to those who need to let go. And it's not something that looks or sounds like Jesus. Those who trust in him, it was there in our psalm as well, those who trust in him, those who look to him, will never be put to shame. Jesus will often ask us to change. That's clear. And to do better and to be better. But a relationship with him will love us into that submission rather than guilt or shame us into that place. Peter says, but you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. So all of this, friends, comes by way of an invitation and of a promise that you have been chosen, that you have been given purpose, that you are a special possession in God's sight. You are loved in that way, that there is understanding and hope because of that truth, and that you have been called out of a place of darkness, which is just an expression of what it means to try and do it on your own and do it your way and struggle on with only your strength of mind and body. That's what darkness is. If the deeper answer, which asks who I am, is about who I am with in relationship with others, then there will always be futility in that which is human. Because even the very best of our human relationships actually require some desperate work to stay anything like good and require a great deal of acceptance of the bad. That's what it means to walk in darkness, that it's never going to be quite all there. But then if my proximity to Jesus is the definition, then I walk in the light. Because in my relationship with Jesus, I am only ever changed and only ever made good and only ever shown love and only ever brought peace and only ever shown mercy. What we see that is clear is that his love never fails. Wherever humanity will let us down in all sorts of different ways, Jesus' love will never fail. Peter finishes this bit of the letter by saying, once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. The last lines perhaps say this in a very simple way. I once was lost, but now am found. Was blind, but now I see. From Amazing Grace. We that can find our way to faith and can accept that we are chosen and are our special or treasured possession will always accept that life will not be easy for now, and that there shall be in pain, there will shall be pain in many ways. But this will always be shadowed, put into insignificance by the wonders that we shall see in walking with Jesus, and particularly as we draw closer to him. In so many ways, when we struggle and fail, when the storms of life are rife and vivid, and when we ask painfully, who am I? That I suffer and struggle and feel condemned by so many things. To all of us in that situation, to you in that situation, Jesus says, here I am. Here I am. Full of mercy, full of love, and full of hope. That things will not always be as they are now. And friends, that's the promise of Jesus. Amen. Let's take a moment to think upon those words and to pray together.